healthcare and housing and could benefit from some of the same medicine, I guess.
Yeah, and some of this has to do with the demographics of the news media industry, which is similar to the demographics of the legal profession and the medical profession, that there aren't enough people who have experienced discrimination directly. But it's also that a good plot has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And so last year, there were a number of stories about bias in home appraisals in which Black families got a low appraisal for their home, and they then got a white friend to sit in for them, and they took down the Jacob Lawrence paintings and the Toni Morrison books. Mm-hmm. And when it appeared that the home was owned by a white person, it was as much as $500,000 more. I'm glad they covered this, and this is a good story. And fair housing groups have sued about appraisal discrimination, and the National Fair Housing Alliance has a whole campaign about it. But nobody connected those instances to the systemic problems in the appraisal industry, which Elizabeth Corver Glenn has written about in her book, Rates Brokers. They haven't related that to the low home value appraisals are connected to high property tax appraisals, as Andrew Carl points out in his great book, The Black Tax. So the information is out there, but it's just that they end the story too soon, and they assume things are going to be all right. Lorraine Hansberry wrote this play called Raisin in the Sun, which is about a Black family moving into a white neighborhood. And at the end of the play, the Black people are in the neighborhood, and critics said, oh, this is a happy ending. And Lorraine Hansberry said, well, if you think that's a happy ending, well, they wake up the next morning and have bricks and rocks thrown at their house, and the neighbors don't talk to them, and the police harass them. And so you can't end the story too soon. We have to think about all these interconnections.
Absolutely. And we could and will continue this conversation much further. But I just want to tell folks that we've been speaking with George Lipsitz. He's research professor emeritus of Black Studies and Sociology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. And the book we're talking about is called The Danger Zone is Everywhere. And it's available now from University of California Press. George Lipsitz, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you, Janine. I really appreciate the conversation.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can get more information on our website, FAIR.org. The show's engineered by Riley Baer. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
Depose from The Faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
WRCT Pittsburgh. Meaty and full of flavor since 1940.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
WRCT. In sound. From way out.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now! More than 200 Jewish activists and their allies were arrested Monday as they blocked entrances to the New York Stock Exchange on Wall Street in one of the largest arrest actions in Wall Street history. They were calling for the U.S. to stop arming Israel. We'll speak to an organizer with Jewish Voice for Peace. This comes as the U.S. is sending an advanced anti-missile defense system and 100 U.S. troops to Israel. We'll speak with a former U.S. Army major who resigned to protest U.S. policy on Gaza. Plus, we look at Donald Trump's threats to deploy soldiers on U.S. soil against what he calls leftists and the enemy within. As the former chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley, warns Trump is a total fascist, we'll speak to fascism scholar Ruth Ben-Ghiat. Then, Union. A new documentary captures the historic campaign by Amazon workers to unionize their warehouse in Staten Island, New York.
And you know that's illegal, right? You're not supposed to be doing that.
This is the long haul, right? This is the marathon.
This is our shot to make things better.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's intensified its ground assault on the northern Gaza Strip, where an estimated 400,000 people remain trapped amidst a dire humanitarian situation. Over the past 24 hours, Israeli attacks have killed at least 55 Palestinians, including 10 people killed by an Israeli tank shell as they lined up for food at a distribution center in Jabalia. Dozens more were wounded in the assault, children among them. On Monday, the World Health Organization began its second round of an emergency polio vaccination campaign after Israel's assault decimated Gaza's water and sanitation infrastructure, prompting a polio outbreak. Parents who brought their children to receive a booster dose said they have much more to fear than the spread of disease.
Today I came to vaccinate my children against polio. We administered the first dose, and now we've administered the second dose, as we are scared of diseases that are widely spread here in Gaza. However, with disease and this fear, we fear the occupation more, because even though we are protecting them and vaccinating them, the occupation is still bombing them.
One of the victims who burned to death after Israel bombed Al-Aqsa Hospital early Monday has been identified as 19-year-old Shaban Al-Dalou. He was an engineering student at Gaza's Al-Azhar University, who just started his studies in September of last year. He built the tent shelter his family was living in when Israel bombed them. At least four others were also killed in the fire. In the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces killed two Palestinians, including a child, and injured four others during an hours-long assault Monday on the city of Jenin and its refugee camp. 23-year-old Mahmoud Mamoun Abu Al-Rab died of gunshot wounds, as did 17-year-old Rayan Ibrahim Al-Sayed. Their killings bring the death toll from Israeli assaults on the West Bank over the past year to 755, including 165 children. In Lebanon, at least 21 people were killed Monday when Israel bombed a four-story apartment building in the northern village of Etu. The UN Human Rights Commission reports 12 women and two children were among the victims. On Monday, a top UNICEF official warned of a lost generation of children in Lebanon, with some 400,000 youths among the estimated 1.2 million displaced by Israel's bombs. This is Jalal Ferhat, a 40-year-old father of five whose family crossed Lebanon's border into Syria Monday seeking refuge.
There are strikes in our neighborhood and destruction, and they struck near my house. I have children. You can't just stay where you are. We tried going to another place. We moved from Baalbek, where they struck near my house. We had to leave again. I have children. You can't stay. We are going to Syria because it could be safer than where we are.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu doubled down Monday in his warnings to the UN interim force in Lebanon, known as UNIFIL, telling UN peacekeepers to, quote, heed Israel's request and to temporarily get out of harm's way, unquote.
The charge that Israel deliberately attacked UNIFIL personnel is completely false. It's exactly the opposite. Israel repeatedly asked UNIFIL to get out of harm's way.
Netanyahu's remarks came after Israeli troops fired on a UNIFIL watchtower and destroyed part of a UNIFIL base near the Israeli border. At least five UNIFIL peacekeepers have been injured by Israel's assaults. Despite the repeated attacks, UNIFIL's chief has said peacekeepers will remain in their positions. On Monday, Britain, France, Germany, and Italy issued a joint statement calling Israel's attacks on UN peacekeepers a violation of international law. And the EU's foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, condemned Israel's attacks on UNIFIL as unacceptable.
The 27 members agreed on asking Israel to stop attacking UNIFIL. Many European members are participating in this mission. Their work is very important. It's completely unacceptable attacking United Nations troops.
The Guardian is reporting USAID officials have been holding regular meetings with Israeli counterparts at Israel's notorious Deir Haman prison since late July, after the Israeli agency overseeing aid relocated to the military base. Deir Haman has been labeled a torture camp, where Palestinians abducted by Israeli soldiers in Gaza have described harrowing physical, sexual, and psychological abuse. The Guardian says it's not clear if the USAID workers have observed the part of the base that is used as a torture camp, but affected officials told the newspaper, quote, I can't sleep at night knowing that it's going on, unquote, and that Israel's relocation of its aid coordination group to the prison, quote, seems like trolling, unquote. You can see our past coverage of Deir Haman and the reports on it at democracynow.org. Here in New York City, hundreds of Jewish activists and their allies rallied outside the New York Stock Exchange Monday, demanding an Israeli arms embargo and an end to war profiteering by companies like Raytheon and Lockheed Martin. Police forcibly removed peaceful protesters as they blocked the entrance to the Stock Exchange, arresting over 200 people in one of the largest mass arrests outside the Stock Exchange in history. After headlines, we'll speak with Elena Stein, director of organizing and strategy for Jewish Voice for Peace. She was detained at Monday's action. Meanwhile, in Washington, D.C., activists with Code Pink disrupted an annual conference at the Association of the U.S. Army.
The blood of hundreds of thousands of people is on your hands. Your pocket steeped in the blood of Palestinians, of people in the global south, from the Philippines to the Congo to Haiti. We have 800 military bases.
Everyone, if you can just
better than you talk about. We have no future. You're making a killing off of killing.
Canada has expelled six Indian diplomats amidst mounting tensions over the murder last year of a Sikh separatist leader in British Columbia. India responded by announcing it's also expelling six Canadian diplomats this week. New Delhi's rejected Canadian accusations that Indian government agents were involved in the killing of Hardeep Singh Nijjar and the targeting of other Indian dissidents in Canada. This is Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau.
Canada is a country rooted in the rule of law, and the protection of our citizens is paramount. That's why when our law enforcement and intelligence officials began pursuing credible allegations that agents of the government of India were directly involved in the killing of a Canadian citizen, Hardeep Singh Nijjar, on Canadian soil, we responded.
And in North Carolina, the Rutherford County Sheriff's Department has arrested a man who allegedly used an assault rifle to threaten workers helping with relief efforts from Hurricane Helene. Investigators charged 44-year-old William Jacob Parsons with the crime of going armed to the terror of the public, a misdemeanor. The incident and other cases of threats and harassment against federal workers prompted FEMA to briefly suspend some of its North Carolina relief operations. FEMA pulled back its workers from going door to door in areas hard hit by hurricane damage. This comes after Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump and his running mate J.D. Vance spent weeks spreading lies and conspiracy theories about FEMA, falsely claiming the agency sent aid meant for hurricane victims to migrants while withholding aid to people in Republican areas. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan, and happy birthday.
Hi, Amy. Thank you, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
The Washington Post is reporting Israel's planning to launch retaliatory strikes against Iran within the next 3 weeks ahead of the U.S. election. Iran fired nearly 200 ballistic missiles at Israeli military and security sites on October 1st. At the time, Iran said the strikes were retaliation for the assassination of Hamas political leader Ismail Haniyeh, who was killed in an explosion in Tehran in July on the day of the inauguration of the new Iranian president. According to the new report in The Washington Post, Israel's now considering striking military sites inside Iran, but not Iran's oil or nuclear facilities. This comes as the Biden administration is sending an advanced anti-missile defense system and 100 U.S. troops to Israel in advance of Israel's attack on Iran. In a statement, a Pentagon spokesperson said, quote, "This action underscores the United States' ironclad commitment to the defense of Israel and to defend Americans in Israel from any further ballistic missile attacks by Iran," unquote. The missile defense system is known as THAAD, Terminal High Altitude Area Defense. Over the past year, the U.S. has sent over 50,000 tons of armaments and military equipment to Israel, but this marks the first significant deployment of U.S. troops to Israel over the past year. A new study by the Cost of War Project at Brown University estimates the U.S. has spent nearly $23 billion on the Israeli military and related operations over the past year. We're joined now by Harrison Mann, a former U.S. Army major who worked at the DIA, that's the Defense Intelligence Agency. Mann, who is Jewish, resigned to protest U.S. support for Israel's war on Gaza. He's now a senior fellow at Win Without War, a network of activists and organizations working for a more peaceful, progressive U.S. foreign policy. Harrison Mann, welcome back to Democracy Now!. If you can talk about the significance of what the U.S. is doing right now, sending the THAAD missiles and the 100 U.S. troops.
Yeah, thanks, Amy. This deployment, I think, sends a very strong message, unfortunately, to the Netanyahu government, which is that if you continue to escalate with Iran, you will be rewarded with the protection of additional U.S. systems and troops. And it also, unfortunately, sends the message that, you know, we've seen the people burning in tents and we've seen you publicly muse about starving everybody in northern Gaza to death, and that's not a deal breaker. In terms of the capability that this provides, the radar that this system depends on, the ANPTY-2, has actually already been located in southern Israel since 2008, operated by U.S. troops. So that detection capability is already there. We're now sending a battery that has about 6 launchers with a total of 48 interceptors. And the reason that I want to mention that number is really all that we've added materially is the ability to shoot down another 48 ballistic missiles if Iran adds them to a barrage. So I see this in many ways as a symbolic show of support that can be easily neutralized if Iran just fires more missiles next time. And then the other issue here is that we are indisputably putting more U.S. troops at risk by sending them to Israel. They're going to be operating out of Israeli military installations. And we've seen, both with the October 1 Iranian attack and then more recent Hezbollah attacks, that Israel's adversaries can penetrate its air defenses and can strike targets within Israeli bases. So we have to be very clear that these troops are entering a combat zone. They are going to be at risk, especially as escalation continues. And unfortunately, they've been sent there, I think, with no consultation with Congress, with no clear legal justification, without the argument that they are needed to go there for urgent self-defense needs.
And Harrison Manny, I wanted to follow up specifically on that issue. Is it your sense that to send troops like this into an existing war, in effect, combat, that what the requirements are in terms of Congress's approval?
Yeah. To introduce troops into hostilities per the 1973 War Powers Act, you either need an authorization from Congress or there needs to be some urgent and imminent self-defense threat. In this case, the supposed self-defense threat is an Iranian missile attack. But the irony here is the Iranian missile attack is only going to happen if we help Israel strike Iran first.
And I also wanted to ask you about a report in the New York Times, a front page article, the lead article in the New York Times today, which talks about the Israel's use of Palestinian detainees as human shields in Gaza, forcing the detainees to, according to the New York Times, to go into tunnels in case they were booby-trapped ahead of Israeli troops, in essence using them as potential victims in order to protect Israeli troops.
Yeah, so this is based off the reporting and investigations from a Israeli group called Breaking the Silence. I had the honor of meeting their CEO, Nadav Weinman, when he was in D.C. a couple months ago, and he told me about this very project and his efforts to document this process. So I can say it is very real. It's unfortunately a systemic practice by Israeli troops, kidnapping Palestinians, sometimes putting GoPros on them, putting Israeli uniforms on them. So if they go up to an enemy position, they're going to look like Israeli soldiers. And at this point, this is kind of the least offensive and illegal thing that we have the Israeli Defense Forces doing in this conflict. So again, going back to the THAAD deployment, I wish we were not reinforcing and encouraging this behavior as the U.S. government.
What is your sense, Harrison Mann, of why President Biden is doing this? He is not a it is not as if he embraces Netanyahu, though certainly in terms of sending weapons, he has done that to the fullest. He recognizes he is clearly a Trump ally. Clearly, Netanyahu wants Trump to win. Trump is former president of the United States, who could face prison if he doesn't win, and Prime Minister Netanyahu could face prison if he is no longer prime minister. Their fates are intertwined. So why is Biden embracing him in this way?
Yeah, the administration for the past year has adhered to this bear hug strategy The idea being that we have to keep giving Israel support and protection, and that's the only way we can get them to listen to us. I think it's obvious that that has not worked. The thinking right now is that by offering this system to Israel's defense, we can at least convince them to avoid striking more sensitive targets in Iran, like nuclear facilities or oil infrastructure. And, you know, that might actually succeed in the short term, but we have to understand, once these troops and this system is deployed in Israel, I don't know what incentive Netanyahu has to continue keeping his word and not keep escalating. And if you're asking why would we keep supporting, or why would the president keep supporting Netanyahu even when he knows that he'd rather have a Republican president, Donald Trump, in office, I think they just can't imagine another strategy. And it's really unfortunate to see that this administration, and to a certain extent the Harris campaign, would rather risk her election than distance themselves from Israel and from the genocide.
And what is your sense of how, the impact of this recent decision to deploy these batteries to Israel, that the impact that's going to have on Iran or other enemies of Israel in the region?
Yeah, so in the near term, I don't think it's going to have a big impact, because Iran knows where these troops will be deployed. And if it responds to Israel's next strike, it can probably successfully avoid hitting them or avoid hitting near them. Unfortunately, as the escalation continues, and if we move beyond symbolic messaging strikes to an actual war of annihilation, these troops are going to become targets, even if it's by accident, right? They probably have a survivability plan. That means they displace to another location in a combat situation. So we're going to get to a point where, even if they want to avoid killing Americans, Iran and Hezbollah may do so by accident. And then the other side of this is that Israel now has its own sort of American human shields that it can leverage to try and avoid a certain level of attacks from Iran, knowing that Iran does not want to kill Americans. And it knows it's got a new mechanism to drag America directly into a war with either Hezbollah or Iran, since now it's much more likely that U.S. troops can be killed on Israeli soil.
I want to ask you something that's not exactly in your wheelhouse, but I'm just curious what you think, as a former official at the Defense Intelligence Agency, about Donald Trump calling for the National Guard or the U.S. military to be deployed on U.S. soil to target what he called radical left lunatics. Trump made the call during an interview on Fox News. This is what he said.
I think the bigger problem are the people from within. We have some very bad people. We have some sick people, radical left lunatics. And I think they're the—and it should be very easily handled by, if necessary, by National Guard, or if really necessary, by the military, because they can't let that happen.
Your response, Harrison Mann.
Yeah, I'll just say, as somebody who's had friends and colleagues who were deployed to D.C. in 2020, or have been deployed on the border mission, I trust, you know, the non-commissioned officers and officers in the Army, in the National Guard, to not be, you know, aggressive against political activity. But I think the danger here is that if you do this deployment, which units might not refuse, you're then in a situation with really unclear guidance about what you're supposed to do with protesters, or what you're supposed to do with whatever group the president has told you to target. So I think, fortunately, our forces know the right thing to do, but when they end up in a situation with very unclear or maybe contradictory guidance between what the president is saying publicly and their own commanders are telling them, you have the risk of unintentional violence or uncontrolled violence.
And finally, Harrison Mann, we are just going into a segment on one of the largest arrest actions outside the New York Stock Exchange. Over 200 Jewish activists and their allies were arrested, calling for the U.S. to stop arming Israel. As a former U.S. Army major who resigned to protest U.S. support for Israel's war on Gaza. As a Jewish American, your thoughts? And also how activists on the outside in the streets, I often think about Dan Ellsberg when I think of this, you know, who is at the Pentagon and the RAND Corporation, and talked about seeing those protesters outside. You're on the inside. What does this mean? You're out now, but many of your colleagues are still in. When they see these kind of mass actions?
Yeah, first, I appreciate that you mentioned that I'm Jewish, too. And with respect to these protesters and my own advocacy, I think it's incredibly important for American Jews to talk about this, especially to demonstrate that Israeli Zionism is not the same as Judaism, and the actions of the Israeli state do not represent all Jews and certainly don't represent American Jews, because unfortunately that's a claim that both Israeli politicians and American politicians like to make, which is that if you care about Jews, you have to support what Israel is doing in Gaza, West Bank, and Lebanon right now, and that's just patently untrue. And then I can tell you both myself and some of the other officials who publicly resigned, We were influenced and affected by protest activity that we saw. In our case, in terms of the timing, the student protests were extremely affecting in feeling like, I'll just speak for myself, that I could no longer justify staying silent when we had 19-year-olds going to get beat up and risk their futures for this cause. So I can't promise that this is going to fix everything, but the people on the inside of our institutions do, in aggregate, notice this activism.
Harrison Mann, I want to thank you for being with us, a former U.S. Army major, a Jewish American who resigned to protest U.S. support for Israel's war on Gaza. He's now a senior fellow at Win Without War, a network of activists and organizations working for a more peaceful, progressive U.S. foreign policy. When we come back, we'll be joined by one of those activists outside the New York Stock Exchange, believed to be one of the largest mass arrests there in U.S. history. She was arrested. She's with Jewish Voice for Peace. Stay with us. I'm Afraid of Americans by David Bowie. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Protests over the U.S. arming Israel are continuing. On Monday morning, more than 200 Jewish activists and their allies were arrested as they blocked entrances to the New York Stock Exchange on Wall Street. The protesters were calling for an Israeli arms embargo, an end to war profiteering by companies like Raytheon and Lockheed Martin. The protest was organized by Jewish Voice for Peace, which said the action was the largest act of civil disobedience in history outside the New York Stock Exchange. Participants in the protests included descendants of Holocaust survivors, as well as Emmy Award-winning comedian Eric Andre, Academy Award-winning filmmaker Laura Poitras, the acclaimed artist Nan Golden, the Oscar-nominated actress Deborah Winger, and the artist Molly Crabapple. Police forcibly remove many of the peaceful protesters, including our next guest, Elena Stein. She's director of organizing and strategy for Jewish Voice for Peace. She was arrested, held for 8 hours. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us, Elena. There's a very dramatic picture of you being taken out, held, carried by police on your back. You're wearing the T-shirt you're wearing right now, Stop Arming Israel. Explain what this action was all about.
First of all, thank you so much for having me, Amy and Juan. I've been watching Democracy Now! Every morning for about 15 years, so appreciate everything you all do. Yesterday, 500 Jewish New Yorkers and friends shut down business as usual at the New York Stock Exchange on Wall Street, demanding, you know, the epicenter of global capital, demanding that the U.S. stop arming Israel and stop profiting from genocide. And, you know, as we arrived in the morning, we were learning the news that just that night, Israel had bombed the Al-Aqsa hospital and had set at least 30 tents ablaze full of people who had already been displaced, who still had IVs in their arms from being at the hospital, burning people alive. And this comes after days and days of massacring whole families in the Jabalia refugee camp as part of the larger strategy to block off, to starve, to essentially complete the ethnic cleansing of northern Gaza, where 400,000 people are. This is being called a genocide within a genocide. People are posting their final goodbyes. So we are filled with horror beyond words, and are attempting just to embody just an ounce of that refusal in our actions. And of course, what's so important for all of us here in the U.S. to understand is that this is being done with U.S. bombs. Those bombs that are massacring family after family in this war of extermination. Because make no mistake, that is the goal, extermination. It is being done with U.S. bombs, with U.S. weapons, and with U.S. cover. With a shielding Israel from accountability at any international institution. Now, the Biden administration wants you to believe that the reason the U.S. is arming and funding and covering the Israeli government like this is for the sake of Jewish safety, right? This is the moral cover that they use. This is the justification used to cloak the entire enterprise. And so we are there to say we reject this myth, this sick myth, with every fiber of our beings. We refuse to let our histories, our identities, our traditions be used to torture, to starve, to massacre, to erase Palestinians. And we are there to say the true interests of the Biden administration, the true interests of the U.S. government are this, in its own imperial interests and its own financial interests. And so we were there to say to the U.S., stop arming Israel, stop profiting from genocide.
And Elena, could you talk about why you chose the stock exchange? Because the reality is that every war that the United States has ever fought, some people have made money off of, some sector of American capitalism. And in this case, could you talk about the arms makers and the huge, obscene amounts of money they are making from this war, companies like Raytheon and Lockheed Martin?
That's exactly right. So most know that every year, the U.S. sends $3.8 billion in military funding to Israel. Now, first thing to know is that this is an unprecedented amount of money. There is no amount of public taxpayer money going annually to any other country like this. The next thing to know is that none of that money is used. When we hear the word aid, we might think, oh, that's for recovery from a natural disaster or for housing or education. No, all of this money has to be used on the Israeli military for military purposes. And not only that, But all that money has to be used then back in the United States on U.S. defense contractors, on U.S. weapons corporations. So we see here that the entire enterprise has the goal of propping up the U.S.'s war economy. Now, $3.8 billion is just the amount of money typically going in taxpayer public funding. It is nothing to say of the billions going in private funding. But this year, the U.S. sent in public funding, the U.S. government sent $18 billion in taxpayer funds to the Israeli military. There are no words to describe how unprecedented this is. And so when we say that it's all in the service of propping up the U.S.'s war economy, it works. This year, the stock prices of weapons manufacturers were skyrocketing. Last year, if you were to invest $10,000 in Raytheon, right now, you would have $18,000 in just 1 year. That's an 80% return in 1 year. Raytheon is the firm making the bunker buster bombs that are prohibited from use in civilian areas that Israel is currently using right now in southern Lebanon. Now, not only that, over 50, at least, members of Congress and their spouses are invested in Raytheon and Lockheed Martin, two of the leading weapons manufacturers. So we can see they are quite literally profiting from this genocide. And these are the people who are voting on increased funding and arms to the Israeli military. Our elected officials should never be able to profit off of genocide. They are there to carry out, supposedly, the will of the people. And you think about this. Just last week, Hurricane Helene ravaged communities across Appalachia, right? Killing hundreds of people, displacing thousands. This is just 1 week before Hurricane Milton did the same, ravaged Florida. And before the wreckage could even be accounted for, after Hurricane Helene, FEMA reported a $9 billion shortfall. At the exact same time, President Biden announced that he'd be releasing another $8.7 billion in military funding to the Israeli military. This is almost the exact same amount of money. So what we are seeing is that quite literally, the United States government is choosing to massacre in mass Palestinians over supporting our communities here in the United States who are trying to recover from this devastating climate crisis, as well as the chronic disinvestment from their communities. And so that's why we were there with 500 people yesterday to say outside of Wall Street, this epicenter of global capital. And yes, as you said, Juan, you know, Wall Street has been profiting off of genocide, every genocide of this country since the founding of this country, since the founding genocides. Wall Street was actually built as the first marketplace of to trade enslaved people kidnapped from the shores of Africa in 17 and then traded in 1711 on Wall Street by the European settlers who'd also carried out the genocide against the indigenous people of Manahatta. And we were there yesterday on Indigenous Peoples Day, and so that's part of why this history is so important to root in. And we pay homage to the many movements that have been protesting Wall Street ever since, from ACT UP, that actually had its founding protest on Wall Street in 1987, delaying the bell. And actually, one of the organizers of that demonstration was with us yesterday in jail, which is so meaningful, to Occupy Wall Street, to many Palestinian-led demonstrations at Wall Street this year. And so that is why we were there, to say altogether, fund FEMA, not genocide, fund housing, not genocide, fund healthcare, not genocide.
I want to turn to Samaya Awad of Adala Justice Project. She's a Palestinian who participated in the protest you were arrested at the New York Stock Exchange. She's speaking here to CBS News.
We refuse for our government to continue doing this, using our tax dollars while our country is suffering from climate disaster, from lack of health care.
I also want to turn to 82-year-old Ross Pachetsky, a MacArthur Fellow, former anti-Vietnam War activist, current member of Jewish Voice for Peace. On Monday, she was one of the oldest people to chain herself to the Wall Street gates. She told CBS why she participated in the protest.
A lot of our resources are going to war. Jews have a long tradition of opposing war.
Ross Pachecki is a professor emeritus at Hunter. As we hear those voices, Elena, you yourself are the granddaughter of a Holocaust survivor. Talk about that, how that informs your activism today, as the back of your T-shirt that says Stop Arming Israel on the front says Not in Our Name.
The day that my grandmother's entire family and village was massacred in a different genocide, the Holocaust, my grandmother just happened to be absent. I grew up knowing this fact and understanding that it means that, first of all, I'm not supposed to be here. My life is a fluke. And I also grew up agonizing over the question of, where were the neighbors? Why did they just stand by? Why didn't they hurl their bodies between the killers and my family? And so today, it's with all of my Jewish ancestors at my back, the one who survived, my grandmother, and all those who didn't, that we, I, and all of them together say loudly, more profoundly than ever before, we refuse to be neighbors who just stand by. And I think so many of us in these demonstrations, especially as we watch the Israeli government cynically use the excuse, use the conflation of Judaism and Zionism. Let's be clear, Judaism is our rich thousands-year-old tradition. Israel is a 76-year-old apartheid state. The cover has been pulled off Israel. People can see it for what it is. And for the Zionist project and the project of ethnic cleansing and genocide and the full expansionist goals that it has, and it will use any means it can to make that project a reality. And the only excuse they have left, the only cover they have left, is to call any resistance to it anti-Semitism. We refuse this. There is nothing anti-Semitic about fighting for people's right to live on their land, to thrive, to be safe at home. We refuse to let our traditions, our identities, our histories be used to allow for the torture, the mass torture, the mass starvation, the massacre and the erasure of Palestinians.
The protest on Monday was the latest in a long string of nonviolent protests led by Jewish Voice for Peace at Grand Central Terminal during rush hour, at the Statue of Liberty, at the Manhattan Bridge. Do you feel the Biden administration is hearing your voice?
Oh, may it be so. Listen, the Biden administration is watching all of us. They have watched the needle move. I mean, two-thirds, the polls are showing that two-thirds of Americans now want an arms embargo. Two-thirds of Americans are saying that they don't want arms to go to Israel. This is astonishing. And let's understand it for what it is, which is an extraordinary win by the Palestinian-led movement for Palestinian liberation. And, of course, we see the Biden administration not listening. We see Congress not listening. All of us are asking, why is this? Well, first of all, it's because we don't live in a democracy. They don't have to listen to us. It is for their own imperial and financial interests. It is for their own interest in controlling the region, which have been broken open and uncovered in so many of the interviews you've done here on Democracy Now!, and it's for their financial interests and financial gain, because we know of the corporate control of this country. And so we see this moment of, I mean, to be quite honest, we see a lot of despair and a lot of hopelessness right now, especially as Israel expands its war of extermination deeper into Gaza and then throughout Lebanon and, you know, bombing Lebanon and Syria and Yemen and the West Bank, and the risk, the threat to soon be bombing Iran at the same time. To watch them not just listen, but to expand it at the same time is truly extraordinary. And to feel so many millions more terrorized as they're watching their loved ones in these other countries now fleeing for their lives as well. And we refuse to give up, right? We take inspiration from all of the movements that came before us that never gave up after 1 year of not winning. We take inspiration especially from the Palestinian struggle that has been here fighting for 76 years and has never thrown in the towel because it is such an uphill battle. And all of us here in the belly of the beast, where we know is in control of these arms and these funding, we must do the exact same. We cannot give up. We must double down right now. And even if the path to that arms embargo is getting increasingly muddled as we see them refuse to listen to us, we know that what all of us must be doing is applying this pressure from every angle possible, and that every single one of us has a role to play.
Elena Stein, I want to thank you for being with us. She is the Jewish Voice for Peace Director of Organizing Strategy, a descendant of a Holocaust survivor. On Monday morning, she was arrested along with about two other Jewish activists and allies in one of the largest acts of 200 Jewish activists and allies in one of the largest acts of civil disobedience the New York Stock Exchange has seen, demanding the U.S. stop arming Israel. When we come back, Union, it's the name of a new film. We'll speak to the co-director and organizer, a documentary about the historic campaign of Amazon workers to unionize their warehouse in Staten Island, New York. Back in 30 seconds.
And I love the way you laugh maniacally at me in the middle of the night for no reason. And the way you smell like polystyrene drying out on a tranquil summer's evening. Can't get enough of your dulcet tones, your terrible jokes, your love of kayaking. And the way you couldn't care less that everything I say is painfully obvious and incredibly boring. Because you're the kind of girl who could spend an interesting evening with a grain of salt. And the fact you declined so many marriage proposals, when that gets me pretty hot. In the beginning was the word, and you've been down since day one. Alexa, set the alarm for 3 a.m. And turn the heating all the way up. Alexa, order a copy of the Cool Greenhouse's new record.
Alexa, by the Cool Greenhouse. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Today, the U.S. Supreme Court set to consider a labor case with major implications for the right of workers to organize. YAP USA Automotive Systems has asked the Supreme Court to block a National Labor Relations Board case that alleges the company illegally interfered with the union election at a Michigan plant. The company is challenging the case in part by claiming the NLRB's structure is unconstitutional. More than 20 other companies, including Amazon, one of the most powerful companies on earth, have filed similar lawsuits challenging the National Labor Relations Board's power. Now a new film documents how Amazon workers at Amazon's JFK 8 Fulfillment Center on Staten Island made history by voting to form the first Amazon union in U.S. history in 2022. The same year, Amazon spent more than $14 million to quash union drives by the company's workers. An NLRB investigation later found Amazon illegally prohibited them from distributing pro-union materials. The documentary is called Union. This is its trailer.
We got to continue to fight because this company has not been held accountable.
Is Chris Smalls, he was fired when he went outside and protested.
You make Amazon $638 million a day. It's time to get paid our fair share.
Cancel all your plans unless it's family related.
They ain't family related, we have to change. Like, we got to.
There's nothing that can stop our momentum. The only thing that's going to stop us is if we stop ourselves.
Right now, Amazon is on their high horse, and we want to punch them in the face.
We should just go in, occupy that training room, and don't even let them hold the meetings.
Can we talk outside?
Hey!
And you know that's illegal, right? You're not supposed to be doing that.
I'm about to give up.
This is the long haul, right? This is the marathon.
This is our shot to make things better.
The demands of workers at Amazon's JFK 8 Staten Island warehouse include better pay, benefits, and working conditions. In this clip from the film union, an Amazon union organizer interrupts a mandatory anti-union meeting the company organized.
We're asking you to do three simple things. Get the facts, ask questions, and vote no to the union.
So that's the ultimate theme. Remember, your signature is worth something. So protect your signature.
Hi, my name is Natalie. I'm a sort inductor on the ship dock, and I'm actually one of the organizers for the Amazon Labor Union. Just to let you know, the leader of the ALU is Chris Smalls. He was fired last April when he went outside and protested because we were not getting PPE inside the factory, even though we were processing it for the rest of the world. Okay, so him and his friends that also worked here got fired. Okay, so when I say that we put a union out there that is worker-led and is Amazon employees, we have all of you in mind. It's workers protecting workers and standing up for workers. No, and you guys, no. I want to say one more thing. You talk about $1,200. Union busters make $2,000 to $3,000 per day paid by Amazon to sell everybody out.
A clip from the new documentary Union, which opens theatrically in New York this Friday at IFC Center. It's directed by the acclaimed filmmakers Brett Story and Steve Meng. Meng joins us now along with Connor Spence, who's in the film, now president of the Amazon Labor Union, IBT Local 1, a member of the Teamsters earlier this year, the ALU affiliated with the International Brotherhood of Teamsters to become ALU-IBT. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! So, Steve, talk about the significance of this film dropping or opening now.
Well, first off, thank you so much for having us. We're huge fans of you and Juan. You know, this is a film that updates a narrative about labor organizing that many have been talking about. You know, we saw a resurgence in labor organizing after almost 50 years of decline in union density. And this was a group of workers in Staten Island, New York, who got together and decided that enough was enough, right? These were workers that have often been called the invisible working class, and that was because they've been largely long been voiceless and disempowered from pushing back and were in many ways considered by traditional unions unorganizable. This was a trillion-dollar company that they took on, and in an incredible feat of organizing and determination, were able to win in a near landslide against Amazon in April of 2022.
And, Steve, given that your film centers on labor rights and so many of the streaming platforms these days are controlled by corporations with their own embattled labor histories, like Apple, for instance, or Amazon. What was the response of the distribution platforms, and what did you have to do to get the film out?
Well, you know, we had the great honor of premiering the film at Sundance, actually receiving an award there. You know, we were one documentary among 15,000 that applied to get into that festival. And despite that, we've also had the distinct honor of experiencing what a lot of doc makers have been experiencing in this industry, which is, you know, in an attempt to distribute a film that falls into the genre of political cinema, you know, we're dealing with a very corporatized, myopic industry that does not necessarily value narratives like this as much. And so we, much like the Amazon Labor Union, have been charting a more independent course to distribute the film on our own. And it's in many ways been a more gratifying and exciting process.
I wanted to go to another clip. In this scene from Union, three Amazon union organizers, including Chris Smalls, who would become the first ALU president, are handcuffed, detained by New York police for being on Amazon warehouse property.
Hey, Chris. Like I said, man, I'm going to ask you, and anyone who's not an Amazon employee has to leave the premise, please. Anyone who is an Amazon employee, I am not speaking to you. You guys are free to stay.
Okay, but are we in a parking lot that says visitor, right?
You are currently trespassing on Amazon property if you are not an Amazon associate. So anyone here
who's not an Amazon associate. You didn't answer the question, though. That sign over there says visitor, right? I'm a visitor.
With who? What are you doing here?
I'm visiting with him. They work here.
How long have you been here for, sir?
A few minutes.
So you're refusing to leave?
No, I said I'm going to leave when he leaves.
Are you refusing to leave?
I said, no, I'm going to leave when he leaves.
Are you leaving us or no?
Yeah, I said yes. Right.
If you're not leaving within the next 2 minutes, you're going to be arrested.
You have 2 minutes.
You're not enforcing no law. Yeah, you're just wasting your time.
You have 30 seconds or you're getting arrested. 30 seconds.
I'm going to get arrested? How am I going to get arrested? For what? For what? You want to arrest me for what?
If you do that,
hey, look, man.
Right now you're obstructing police business right now. Back
no, you're not. No, you're not. Get up out of here.
No. What's up? He's a word killer. He's worth it.
So Chris Smalls, who had become the president, first president of American Labor Union, was arrested there. He had already been fired as an Amazon worker for protesting the lack of COVID protocols. We're joined by Connor Spence, who is the second president of the American Labor Union. You also were fired of the Amazon Labor Union. You also were fired. You were there at that moment.
Yeah.
Talk about how Amazon cracked down on all of you. You still remain today, this Staten Island warehouse, the only unionized warehouse, Amazon unionized warehouse in the country.
Yeah, I mean, we are probably the most surveilled workforce anywhere.
1.5 million workers?
Yeah. And when you're in the warehouse, everything's tracked, every movement you make, the time you're away from your station. And Amazon can really weaponize that against you once you start to unionize. They can find ways to fire you. They found a way to fire Chris when he was protesting the lack of safety protocols during the pandemic. They found a way to fire me for a policy that the NLRB now considers to be illegal and ordered them to rescind nationally. They have a lot of ways that they can retaliate against organizers, and both Chris and I have, unfortunately, had the police called on us by Amazon, been arrested, never goes anywhere, but it is an intimidation tactic they use. It's a way they try to control the workforce and waste your time and prevent you from being able to organize and talk to people.
Yeah, Connor, I wanted to follow up on that, because given the fact that Amazon has so many employees and they are usually in these huge fulfillment centers, 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 workers in a place, why it's been so difficult for the organized labor to make any inroads other than in your fulfillment center, your warehouse, in terms of unionizing Amazon?
Yeah, I would say, like, by design, basically it's built to be difficult to organize. The turnover in an Amazon warehouse on average is 150%. So our campus on Staten Island alone churns through about, you know, there's 10,000 workers, so churn through about 15,000 New Yorkers every year. And that's by design. That's not an accident. The average worker stays about 8 months before they quit. They're fired by a computer or they injure themselves. So already going in, like, that's a difficult task to organize. There's a scene in the documentary where the first time that we had filed for an NLRB election, we needed to sign up 30% of the active employees of the workforce in order to have a sufficient showing of interest to get the NLRB to come do a union election at our warehouse. But by the time we submitted those cards, I think over 1,000 of them were for employees that had been fired or quit since. So already it's a huge task for any union to take on. As far as what made us successful, I would say, you know, a lot of it was endurance. We had a model of organizing that was very much worker to worker. We We're inside the warehouse, building relationships with people, creating that sense of community. We started as an independent union, so we were basically a blank slate. There wasn't much Amazon could do to union bust or try to third party and separate people from the union, which is a common tactic that these corporations often try to do. They try to third party the union, make workers feel as though it's something that they're not a part of, they're not responsible for. And so I think a lot of things kind of aligned in our case that we were able to be victorious when it's clearly really a struggle to organize and unionize these warehouses.
We just have 10 seconds. Why did you decide to affiliate with Teamsters?
It's national organizing is too much for an independent union to do by ourselves. And if we want to have a chance of taking Amazon to the table, creating that pressure, there has to be national organizing.
I want to thank you both for being with us. The film opens this week.
This Wednesday at IFC Center in New York City and then across the country.
Steve Meng is co-director of Union. Connor Spence is president of the Amazon Labor Union, IBT Local 1. Again, happy birthday to Juan Gonzalez. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
Those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
I'm Richard Gordon. Thanks so much for tuning in to Forbes Avenue on WRCT. Back in July of 2021, I had a really interesting conversation with Brian Junker from the Carnegie Mellon Department of Statistics and Data Science. He has since retired from the university, but I think a lot of the things that he had to say about numeracy, learning how to deal with numbers and statistics like you learn to deal with words, still rings true today. Hi, I'm Richard Gordon from WRCT, and I'm joined here on a park bench on a beautiful summer day by Carnegie Mellon University professor Brian Junker. Brian, what department are you in?
Hi, Richard. It's good to be here. I'm in the Department of Statistics and Data Science.
Okay. I'm so old that when I went to college, there was no computer science major. There was applied math. How long has statistics always had its own departments?
No, statistics used to be a part of the math department, and that's generally historically how statistics departments get started. Eventually, the mathematicians and the statisticians realize they can't talk to each other very well, and so statistics breaks off and forms its own department. That happened in the the late 60s or the 70s at Carnegie Mellon.
Okay, well, we're not here to talk about office politics. We're here to talk about lies, damn lies, and statistics.
Oh, man, you really like to offend statisticians when you interview them, don't you?
Well, you know, ever since I was a kid, you know, like reading Mad Magazine and stuff, I can remember there was one joke book about chocolate. And one of the points was how much protein was in chocolate. And here was the stat about this enormous amount of protein. But then there was an asterisk noting the gargantuan amount of chocolate you'd have to eat. I think that's everybody's sort of the layperson's appreciation of statistics. It's like people tell their own stories, making things up with the numbers.
Right. Absolutely true. And in fact, for the last, 30, 40 years, there's been a strong movement toward increasing numeracy for the layperson, just like literacy was a big issue that led to the formation of public schools and things like that. But I will say that, you know, once you become a little bit numerate, that is, once you sort of become a little bit less afraid of the numbers and can interpret them, what you realize is that all those lies and damn lies are equally tellable with numbers as with language. Open the newspaper. Look at what's in the newspaper that's written in English. Listen to, your favorite news channel that you hate. And listen to what they have to say. With no numbers at all, they're equally capable of lying. So it's just learning another language, like learning French or German or Chinese.
People can do so many different things with the numbers. Like one of the quotes you had up on your website from C.H. Combs was, we buy information with assumptions. And those assumptions show up in the numbers that we have, that we hear in the news.
You know, it's funny you bring that up. I actually specifically went and refound that quote myself because I wanted to make sure to bring it up during our talk today. It's one of my favorite aphorisms. It really is. Assumptions are really important. I mean, what you can collect from the real world, what you collect is facts. You collect data without any context or interpretation. And the way you convert that data into information, first of all, is by organizing it. And organizing it requires assumptions. You have to sort of know what you're looking for when you're organizing the data. And then to actually use that information in some useful way, you typically are trying to make a prediction about the future. And the only way to do that is to make assumptions about how the data was generated and how it'll happen in the future. So, yeah, you have to have raw information, you have to have assumptions, you combine them, and that's how you get knowledge and prediction. And if you have the wrong assumptions,